20 minutes later, somewhere in the American sector, Slothrop is ambling past a cabaret where blank-faced snowdrops are lounging in front and inside, and a radio or phonograph somewhere is playing an Irving Berlin medley. Slothrop goes hunching paranoically along the street, hears God Bless America, and This Is the Army, Mr. Jones, and they are his country's versions of the Horst Wessel song, although it is Gustav back at the Jakobistrasse who raves, nobody gonna pull an Anton Webern on him, to a blinking American lieutenant colonel, "A parabola, a trap, you were never immune over there from the simple-minded German symphonic arc, tonic to dominant, back again to tonic, grandeur, Gesellschaft." "Teutonic?" says the colonel. "Dominant? The war's over, fella. What kind of talk is that?" In from the soggy fields of the Mark comes a cold drizzle blowing.
"Russian cavalry are crossing the Kurfürstendamm, driving a herd of cows to slaughter, lowing and muddy, eyelashes beaded with the fine rain."
In the Soviet sector, girls with rifles slung across bouncing, wool-covered breasts are waving the traffic around with bright orange pennants. Bulldozers growling, trucks straining, push over teetering walls, and little kids cheer at each wet crash. Silver tea services ring on fronded terraces where water drips. Waiters in lean black coats wheel and tilt their heads. An open Victoria splashes by, two Russian officers covered with medals, sitting with their ladies in silk frocks and great floppy-brimmed hats trailing ribbons in the breeze. On the river, ducks with green heads glittering drift among shockwaves of one another's passage. Wood smoke scatters out the dented pipe of Margarita's house. Inside the door, the first thing Slothrop sees is a high-heeled shoe come flying straight at his head. He twitches out of the way in time. Margarita is kneeling on the bed, breathing rapidly, staring. "You left me. Had some chores." He rummages in covered cans on a shelf over the stove, finds dried clover tops for tea. "But you left me alone." Her hair blows in a gray-black cloud around her face. She is prey to interior winds he never felt. "Only for a little while. Do you want tea?" Starting outside with an empty can. "What's a little while? For God's sake, haven't you been alone?" "Sure." Dipping up water from a rain barrel outside the door. She lies, shaking, her face working, helpless. Slothrop puts the can on to boil. "You were sleeping pretty soundly. Isn't it safe here? Is that what you mean?" "Safe." A terrible laughter. He wishes she wouldn't. The water has begun to creak. "You know what they were doing to me? What they were piling on my breasts? The names they were calling me?" "Who, Greta?" "When you left, I woke up. I called to you, but you didn't come back. When they were sure you'd left, they came in." "Why didn't you try to stay awake?" "I was awake." Sunlight, switched on, breaks through. At the harsh lighting, she turns her face away. While he makes tea, she sits on the bed, cursing him in German and Italian, in a voice always just at the edge of falling apart. He hands her a cup. She knocks it out of his hand. "Look, take it easy, all right?" He sits down next to her and blows on his tea. The cup she refused stays on its side where it is. The dark stain steams into the wood planks. Far away, clover rises, disperses, a ghost. After a while, she takes his hand. "I'm sorry I left you alone." She starts to cry, and cries all day. Slothrop falls asleep, keeps drifting up to her sobs, and to feel her always in touch, some part of her, some part of him. In a dream from this time, his father has come to find him. Slothrop has been wandering at sundown by the Mangahanuk, near a rotting old paper mill, abandoned back in the 90s. A heron rises in silhouette against luminous and dying orange. "Son?" A falling tower of words tumbling over and over themselves. "The president died 3 months ago." Slothrop stands and curses him. "Why didn't you tell me? Pop, I loved him. You only wanted to sell me to the IG. You sold me out." The old man's eyes fill with tears. "Oh, son." Trying to take his hand, but the sky is dark, the heron gone, the empty skeleton of the mill and the dark increase of the river saying, "It is time to go." Then his father is gone, too. No time to say goodbye, though his face stays, Broderick, who sold him out, long after waking, and the sadness Slothrop brought into it, fool, loudmouth kid. Margarita is leaning over him, brushing tears from his face with the tips of her nails. The nails are very sharp, and paws often when they approach his eyes. "I'm afraid," she whispers. Everything, my face in the mirror. When I was a child, they said not to look in the mirror too often or I'd see the devil behind the glass and... Glancing back at the white-flowered mirror behind them, we have to cover it, please. Can't we cover it? That's where they... Especially at night. Easy. He moves to put as much of their bodies in touch as he can. He holds her. The tremor is strong and maybe uncommable. After a while, Swarthrop has started to tremble too, in phase. Please, take it easy. Whatever possesses her needs touch, to drink touch insatiably. The depth of this frightens him. He feels responsible for her safety and often trapped. At first they stay together days at a clip, till he has to go out dealing or foraging. He doesn't sleep much. He finds himself by reflex telling lies. It's all right. There's nothing to worry about. Sometimes he manages to be alone out by the river, fishing with a piece of string in one of her hairpins. They manage a fish a day, on lucky days, too. They are goofy fish. Anything swimming in Berlin waters these days has to be everybody's last choice. When Greta cries in her sleep for longer than he can listen to, he has to wake her. They will try to talk or to screw, though he's less and less often in the mood, and that makes her worse because she feels he's rejecting her, which indeed he is. Whippings seem to comfort her, and they let him off the hook. Sometimes he's too tired even for that. She keeps provoking him. One night he puts in front of her a broiled fish, an unwholesome yellow loach with brain damage. She can't eat it. She'll get sick. You have to eat. She moved her head aside, first one side, then the other. Oh, boy, what a sad story. Listen, cunt, you ain't the only one that ever suffered. You been out there lately? Of course, I keep forgetting how you must have suffered. Shit, you Germans are crazy. You all think the world's against you. I'm not a German. Just remembering, I'm a Lombard. Close enough, sweetheart. With a hiss, nostrils wide, she grabs the little table and wrenches it away. Plates, silverware, fish flying splat against the wall where it commences to drip down toward the woodwork, still, even in death, getting all the lousy breaks. They sit in their two straight chairs, a meter and a half of perilously empty space between. It is the warm, romantic summer of 45, and surrender or not, the culture of death still prevails. What grandmother called a crime of passion has become, in the absence of much passion over anything today, the technique of preference in resolving interpersonal disputes. Clean it up. She flicks a pale, bitten thumbnail from one of her top teeth and laughs, that delightful Erdmann laugh. Slothrop, shaking, is about to say, "You don't know how close you are." Then by chance he happens to get a look at her face. Of course, she knows how close she is. Okay, okay. He throws her underwear around the room till he finds the black girdle he's looking for. The metal clips of the suspenders raise dark little curved welts over fading earlier bruises on her buttocks and thighs. He has to draw blood before she cleans up the fish. When she's finished, she kneels and kisses his boots. Not exactly the scenario she wanted, but close enough, sweetheart. Getting closer every day, and he's afraid. He's never seen anything like it. When he goes out to the city, she begs to be tied with her stockings, star fashion, to the bedposts. Sometimes she'll leave the house and stay away for days, coming home with stories about Negro MPs beating her with nightsticks, screwing her in the asshole, how much she loved it, hoping to trigger some race-sex reaction, something a little bizarre, a little different. Whatever it is with her, he's catching it. Out in the ruins, he sees darkness now at the edges of all the broken shapes, showing from behind them. Light nests in Margarita's hair like black doves. He will look at his chalk hands, and along the borders of each finger, darkness will gutter and leap. In the sky over the Alexanderplatz, he has seen Oberst Enzian's KEZVH mandala and the face of Tichernia on more than one random snowdrop. Across the facade of the Titania Palast, in red neon through a mist one night, he saw, "Die, Slothrop." One Sunday, at Advanze, an armada of sails all bent the same way, patiently, dreamlike, into the wind, passing forever against the other shore, a crowd of little kids in soldier hats, folded from old army maps, plotted to drown and sacrifice him. He escaped only by murmuring, "Hauptstufe," three times. The house by the river, is an enclosure that acts as a spring suspension for the day and the weather, allowing only mild cycling of light and heat, down into evening, up again into morning to the midday peak, but all damped to a gentle sway from the earthquake of the day outside. When Greta hears shots out in the increasingly distant streets, she will think of the sound stages of her early career, and will take the explosions as cue calls for the titanic sets of her dreams to be smoothly clogged with 1,000 extras. Meek, herded by rifle shots, ascending and descending, arranged into patterns that will suit the director's ideas of the picturesque, a river of faces made up yellow and white-lipped for the limitations of the film stock of the time, sweating yellow migrations taken over and over again, fleeing nothing, escaping nowhere. It's early morning now. Sothrop's breath is white on the air. He is just up from a dream, part one of a poem, with woodcuts accompanying the text. The woman is attending a dog show, which is also in some way a stud service. She has brought her Pekingese, a female with a sickeningly cute name, Mimsy or Gugu or something, here to be serviced. She is passing the time in a garden setting with some other middle-class ladies like herself when from some enclosure nearby, she hears the sound of her bitch coming. The sound goes on and on for much longer than seems appropriate, and she suddenly realizes that the sound is her own voice, this interminable cry of dog pleasure. The others politely are pretending not to notice. She feels shame, but is helpless, driven now by a need to go out and find other animal species to fuck. She sucks the penis of a multicolored mongrel who has tried to mount her in the street. Out in a barren field, near a barbed wire fence, winter fires across the clouds. A tall horse compels her to kneel, passively, and kiss his hooves. Cats and minks, hyenas and rabbits, fuck her inside automobiles, lost at night in the forests, out beside a waterhole in the desert. As part two begins, she has discovered she's pregnant. Her husband, a dumb, easygoing screen door salesman, makes an agreement with her. Her own promise is never stated, but in return, 9 months from now, he will take her where she wants to go. So it is that close to the end of her term he is out on the river, an American river, in a rowboat, hauling on the oars, carrying her on a journey. The key color in this section is violet. Part three finds her at the bottom of the river. She has drowned, but all forms of life fill her womb. Using her as mermaid, line seven, they transport her down through these green river depths. It was down and out again. Old Squadidossi, plowman of the deep, at the end of his day's sowing, sees her verdigris belly among the weeds, lines 10 to 13, and brings her back up. He is a classically bearded Neptune figure with an old serene face. From out of her body streams a flood now of different creatures, octopuses, reindeer, kangaroos. Who can say all the life that left her womb that day? Squadidossi can only catch a glimpse of the amazing spill as he bears her back toward the surface. Above it is a mild and sunlit green lake or pond, grassy at the banks, shaded by willows. Insects whine and hover. The key color now is green. And there, as it broke to sun, her corpse found sleep in the water, and in the summer depths the creatures took their way, each to its proper love, in the height of afternoon, as the peaceful river went. This dream will not leave him. He baits his hook, hunkers by the bank, drops his line into the Spey. Presently he lights up an army cigarette and stays still then for a long while as the fog moves white through the riverbank houses, and up above the warplanes go droning somewhere invisible, and the dogs run barking in the back streets.
When emptied of people, the interior is steel gray. When crowded, it's green, a comfortable acid green.
Sunlight comes in through portals in the higher of the bulkheads. The Rücksichtslos here lists at a permanent angle of 23 degrees, 27 minutes, and steel washbowls line the lower bulkheads. At the end of each sub-latrine are coffee messes and hand-cranked peep shows. You'll find all the older, less glamorous, un-Teutonic-looking women in the enlisted men's machines. The real stacked and more racially golden tomatoes go to the officers, natürlich. This is some of that Nazi fanaticism. The Rüxichschloss itself is the issue of another kind of fanaticism, that of the specialist. This vessel here is a toilet ship, a triumph of the German mania for subdividing. If the house is organic, argued the crafty early toilet ship advocates, family lives in the house. Family's organic. House is outward and visible sign, you see. Behind their smoked glasses and under their gray crew cuts, not believing a word of it, Machiavellian and youthful, not quite ripe yet for paranoia. And if the bathroom's part of the house, house is organic. Ha ha. Singing, chiding, pointing out the broad, blonde-faced engineer, hair parted in the middle and slicked back, actually blushing and looking at his knees among the good-natured, smiling teeth of his fellow technologists because he'd been about to forget that point. Albert Speer himself, in a gray suit with a smudge of chalk on the sleeve, all the way in the back, leaning akimbo the wall and looking remarkably like American cowboy actor Henry Fonda, has already forgotten about the house being organic, and nobody points at him, R.H.I.P. Then the toilet ship is to the Kriegsmarine as the bathroom is to the house. Because the Navy is organic, we all know that, ha ha. General, or maybe Admiral, laughter. The Rüxichschloss was intended to be the flagship of a whole Geschwader of toilet ships. But the steel quotas were diverted clear out of the Navy over to the A-4 rocket program. Yes, that does seem unusual, but Degenkolb was heading up the rocket committee by then, remember, and had both power and will to cut across all branches of the service. So the Rüxichschloss is one of a kind. Old warship collectors, and if you're in the market, you better hurry, because GE's already been by to have a look. Lucky the Bolshies didn't get it, huh, Charles? Charles, meantime, is making on his clipboard what look like studious notes, but are really observations of the passing scene, such as, they are all looking at me, or Lieutenant Rinto is plotting to murder me, and, of course, the ever-reliable, he's one of them, too, and I'm going to get him some night. Well, by now, Charles's colleague here, Steve, has forgotten about the Russians and discontinued his inspection of a flushing valve to take a really close look at that Charles. You can't pick your search team, not if you're just out of school, and here I am in the asshole of nowhere, not much more than a gopher to this... What is he, a fag? What am I? What does GE want me to be? Is this some obscure form of company punishment, even, good God, permanent exile? I'm a career man. They can keep me out here 20 years if they want, and nobody will ever know. They'll just keep writing it off to overhead. Sheila! How am I going to tell Sheila? We're engaged. This is her picture. Hair waved like choppy seas falling down Rita Hayworth style. Eyes that, if it were a color snap, would have yellow lids with pink rims and a mouth like a hot dog bun on a billboard. Took her out to Buffalo Bayou. Looking for a little fun? Big old bayou mosquito, oh my, you should have seen what he done. Poked his head up under her dress, give a little grin, and, well, I guess things got rough on Buffalo Bayou. Skeeter, turn your meter down. All right now, ya-ta-ta-ta, ya-ta-ta-ta-ta. Looking for a little fun, everybody. Oh, you know, when you're young and wholesome, everybody in this case, a toilet shipload of bright, horn-rimmed, shoe-packed young fellows from Schenectady are singing along behind this recitative here, and a good church-going kid, it's sure a mournful thing to get suddenly ganged by a pack of those Texas mosquitoes that can set you back 20 years. Why, there's boys just like you wandering around, you may have seen one in the street today and never known it, with the mind of an infant, just because those mosquitoes got to him and did their unspeakable thing. And we've laid down insecticides, eh, and bombed the bayous with citronella, and it's no good, folks. They breed faster than we can kill them, and are we just going to tuck tail and let them be there out in Buffalo Bayou where my gal Sheila had to look at the loathsome behavior of those things? We going to allow them even to exist? And things got rough on Buffalo Bayou. Skeeter, turn your meter down. Hubba hubba. Skeeter, turn your meter down. Well, you can't help but wonder who's really the more paranoid of the two here. Steve's sure got a lot of gall bad-mouthing Charles that way. Among the hilarious graffiti of visiting mathematicians, integral of 1 over cabin in parentheses times D times cabin in parentheses equals log cabin plus C equals houseboat. That sort of thing. They go poking away down the narrow sausage-shaped latrine now, 2 young/old men. Their feet fade and cease to ring on the sloping steel deck. Their forms grow more transparent with distance until it's impossible to see them anymore. Only the empty compartment here, the S-curved spokes on the peep-show machines, the rows of mirrors directly facing, reflecting each other, frame after frame, back in a curve of very great radius. Out to the end of this segment of curve is considered part of the space of the Rücksichtsschloss, making it a rather fat ship, carrying its right-of-way along with it. Crew morale, whispered the foxes at the ministry meetings, sailors' superstitions, mirrors at high midnight. We know, don't we? The officers' latrines, by contrast, are done in red velvet. The decor is 1930s safety manual. That is, all over the walls, photo graffiti are pictures of horrible disasters in German naval history. Collisions, magazine explosions, U-boat sinkings, just the thing if you're an officer trying to take a shit. The foxes have been busy. Commanding officers get whole suites, private shower, and sunken bathtub. Manicurist, BDM volunteers mostly, steam room, massage table. To compensate, though, all the bulkheads and the overhead are occupied by enormous photographs of Hitler in various forms of play. The toilet paper is covered square after square with caricatures of Churchill, Eisenhower, Roosevelt, Chiang Kai-shek. There was even a staff caricaturist always on duty to custom illustrate blank paper for those connoisseurs who are ever in search of the unusual. Wagner and Hugo Wolf were patched into speakers from up in the radio shack. Cigarettes were free. It was a good life on board the toilet ship Rücksichtsschloss as it plied its way from Swinemünde to Helgoland. Any place it was needed, camouflaged in shades of gray, turn-of-the-century style with sharp-shadowed prows coming at you from midship so you couldn't tell which way she was headed. Ship's company actually lived, each man inside his stall, each with his own key and locker, pin-ups and library shelves decorating the partitions. And there were even one-way mirrors, so you could sit at your ease, penis dangling toward the ice-cold seawater in your bowl. Listen to your VE-301 People's receiver and watch the afternoon rush, the busy ringing of feet and talk, card games inside the group toilets, dealers enthroned on real porcelain receiving visitors, some of them lined up back outside the compartment. Quiet queues, all business, something like the queues in banks. Toilet lawyers dispensing advice, all kinds of visitor coming and going, the U-boat crews hunching in, twitching eyes nervously every second or two at the overhead, destroyer sailors larking at the troughs, gigantic troughs, running the whole beam of the ship, even, legend has it, off into mirror space, big enough to seat 40 or 50 aching assholes side by side, while a constant river of salt flushing water roared by underneath. Lighting wads of toilet paper is what they especially liked to do, setting them flaming yellow in the water upstream and cackling with glee as one by one down the line the sitters leaped off the holes, screaming and clutching their blistered asses and inhaling the smell of singed pubic hair. Not that the crew of the toilet ship itself were above a practical joke now and then. Who can ever forget the time shipfitters Hoepmann and Kois, at the height of the ptomaine epidemic of 1943, routed those waistlines into the ventilation system of the executive officer's stateroom? The exec, being an old toilet ship hand, laughed good-naturedly at the clever prank and transferred Hoepmann and Kois to icebreaker duty, where the two scatotechnic snipes went on to erect vaguely turd-shaped monoliths of ice and snow all across the Arctic. Now and then one shows up on an ice floe drifting south in ghostly grandeur, exciting the admiration of all. A good ship, a good crew, Merry Christmas, and turn to. Horst Achtfaden, late of the Elektromechanische Werke, Karlshagen, another cover name for the testing station at Peenemünde, has really no time for naval nostalgia. With the technical spies of three or four nations after him, he has had the disastrous luck to have been picked up by the Schwarzkommando, who, for all he knows, now constitute a nation of their own. They have interned him in the chief's head. He has watched voluptuous Gerda and her fur boa go through the same number 178 times. He has jimmied the coin box and figured a way to override it, since they put him in here and the thrill is gone. What do they want? Why are they occupying a derelict in the middle of the Kiel Canal? Why don't the British do something about this? Look at it this way, Achtfaden. This toilet ship here is a wind tunnel's all it is. If tensor analysis is good enough for turbulence, it ought to be good enough for history. There ought to be nodes, critical points. There ought to be super derivatives of the crowded and insatiate flow that can be set equal to zero and these critical points found. 1904 was one of them. 1904 was when Admiral Rozhdestvensky sailed his fleet halfway around the world to relieve Port Arthur, which put your present captor Enzian on the planet. It was the year the Germans all but wiped out the Hereros, which gave Enzian some peculiar ideas about survival. It was the year the American food and drug people took the cocaine out of Coca-Cola, which gave us an alcoholic and death-oriented generation of Yanks, ideally equipped to fight World War II. And it was the year Ludwig Prandtl proposed the boundary layer, which really got aerodynamics into business and put you right here, right now. 1904, Achtbaden. Ha-ha! That's a better joke on you than any singed asshole, all right. A lot of good it does you. You can't swim upstream, not under the present dispensation anyhow. All you can do is attach the number to it and suffer, Horst, fella. Or if you can tear yourself away from Gerda and her fur boa, here's a thought. Find a non-dimensional coefficient for yourself. This is a wind tunnel you're in, remember? You're an aerodynamics man, so... coefficients. Yeah. Achtfaden flings himself disconsolately on the scarlet VD toilet way down at the very end of the row. He knows about coefficients. In Aachen, once for a while, he and his colleagues could stand in the forward watchtower, look out into the country of the barbarians through Hermann and Wieselberger's tiny window. Terrific compressions, diamond shadows writhing like snakes. Often the sting was bigger than the model itself. The very need to measure interfered with the observations. That should have been a clue right there. No one wrote then about supersonic flow. It was surrounded by myth and by a pure, primitive terror. Professor Wagner of Darmstadt predicted that at speeds above Mach 5, air would liquefy. Should pitch and roll frequencies happen to be equal, the resonance would throw the projectile into violent oscillations. It would corkscrew to destruction. Lunar motion, we called it. Bingen pencils, we would call the helical contrails in the sky. Terrified. The Schlieren shadows danced. At Peenemünde, the test section measured 40 by 40 centimeters, about the size of a tabloid page. They pray not only for their daily bread, Seisermann had said, but also for their daily illusion. We, staring through the thick glass, had our daily shock, the only paper many of us read. You come in, just hit town, here in the heart of downtown Peenemünde. Hey, what you do for fun around here? Hauling your provincial valise with a few shirts, a copy of the Handbuch, perhaps Kranz's Lehrbuch der Ballistik. You have memorized Akeret, Busemann, von Karman, and Moore, some Volta Congress papers. But the terror will not go away. This is faster than sound, than the words she spoke across the room, so full of sunlight. The jazz band on the radio when you could not sleep. The hoarse Heils among the pale generators and from the executive crammed galleries overhead. The Gomerians whistling from the high ravines. Terrific falls, steepness, whistling straight down the precipice to a toy village lying centuries, miles below. As you sat out on the counter of the KDF ship alone, apart from the maypole dancing on the white deck, the tanned bodies full of beer and song, paunches in sunsuits, and you listened to Ur-Spanish, whistled not voiced from the mountains around Chipuda. Gomera was the last piece of land Columbus touched before America. Did he hear them, too, that last night? Did they have a message for him, a warning? Could he understand the prescient goat-herds in the dark up in the Canarian holly and the fire gone dead green in the last sunset of Europe? In aerodynamics, because you've only got the thing on paper at first, you use dimensionless coefficients, ratios of this to that, centimeters, grams, seconds, neatly all canceling out above and below. This allows you to use models, arrange an airflow to measure what you're interested in, and scale the wind tunnel results all the way up to reality without running into too many unknowns. Because these coefficients are good for all dimensions. Traditionally, they are named after people. Reynolds, Prandtl, Pekele, Nusselt, Mach. And the question here is, how about an Achtfaden number? How's chances for that? Not good. The parameters breed like mosquitoes in the bayou. Faster than he can knock them off. Hunger, compromise, money, paranoia, memory, comfort, guilt. Guilt gets a minus sign around Achtfaden, though, even if it is becoming quite a commodity in the zone. Remittance men from all over the world will come to Heidelberg before long to major in guilt. There will be bars and nightclubs catering especially to guilt enthusiasts. Extermination camps will be turned into tourist attractions. Foreigners with cameras will come piling through in droves, tickled and shivering with guilt. Sorry. Not for Achtfaden here, shrugging at all his mirror-to-mirror replications, chaining out to port and starboard. He only worked with it up to the point where the air was too thin to make a difference. What it did after that was none of his responsibility. Ask Weichensteller, ask Flaum and Fiebel. They were the re-entry people. Ask the guidance section. They pointed it where it was going. Do you find it a little schizoid, allowed now to all the Achtfaden fronts and backs, breaking a flight profile up into segments of responsibility? It was half bullet, half arrow. It demanded this, we didn't. So, perhaps you used a rifle, a radio, a typewriter. Some typewriters in Whitehall, in the Pentagon, killed more civilians than our little A4 could have ever hoped to. You are either alone absolutely, alone with your own death, or you take part in the larger enterprise, and you share in the deaths of others. Are we not all one? Which is your choice? Faringer now, buzzing and flat through the filters of memory. The little cart or the great one? Mad Faringer, the only one of the Peenemünde Club who refused to wear the exclusive pheasant feather badge in his hatband because he couldn't bring himself to kill, who could be seen evenings on the beach sitting in full lotus position staring into the setting sun, and who was first at Peenemünde to fall to the SS, taken away one noon into the fog, his lab coat a flag of surrender, presently obscured by the black uniforms, leather and metal of his escort.
Leaving behind a few joss sticks,
a copy of the Chinesische Blätter für Wissenschaft und Kunst, pictures of a wife and children no one had known about. Was Peenemünde his mountain, his cell and fasting? Had he found his way free of guilt, fashionable guilt? Atman, Atman, not only to breathe, but also the soul, the breath of God. One of the few times Achtfaden can remember talking with him alone directly. Atmen is a genuinely Aryan verb. Now tell me about the speed of the exhaust jet.
What do you want to know? 6,500 feet per second.
Tell me how it changes.
It remains nearly constant through the burning.
And yet the relative airspeed changes drastically, doesn't it? Zero up to Mach 6. Can't you see what's happening?
No, Faringer.
The rocket creating its own great wind. No wind without both rocket and atmosphere. But inside the Venturi, breath, furious and blazing breath, always flows at the same unchanging speed. Can't you really see?
Gibberish. Or else a koan that Achtfaden isn't equipped to master. A transcendent puzzle that could lead him to some moment of light, almost as good as, what is it that flies?
Los.
Rising from the Wasserkuppe, rivers Ulster and Hauna tilting around into map shapes, green valleys and mountains, the four he has left below gathering up the white shock cords, only one looking up, shading his eyes.
Bert, Fiebel, but what does the name matter from this vantage?
Achtfaden goes looking for the thunderstorm, under, through the thunder, playing to a martial tune inside his head, crowding soon in gray cliffs to the right, the strokes of lightning banging all the mountains blue, the cockpit briefly filled with the light, right at the edge, right here at the interface, the air will be rising. You follow the edge of the storm with another sense, the flight sense, located nowhere, filling all your nerves, as long as you stay always right at the edge between fair lowlands and the madness of Donar, it does not fail you. Whatever it is that flies, this carrying drive toward, is it freedom? Does no one recognize what enslavement gravity is till he reaches the interface of the thunder? No time to work out puzzles. Here come the Schwarzkommando. Achtfaden has wasted too much time with luscious Gerda, with memories. Here they come clattering down the ladders, fast ooga-booga talk he can't even guess at. It's a linguistic wilderness here, and he's afraid. What do they want? Why won't they leave him in peace? They have their victory. What do they want with poor Achtfaden? They want the Schwarzgerät. When Enzian actually pronounces the word aloud, it's already redundant. It was there in his bearing, the line of his mouth. The others back him, rifles slung, half a dozen African faces mobbing the mirrors with their darkness, their vein-heavy red, white, and blue eyes. I only was assigned to part of it. It was trivial, really. Aerodynamics isn't trivial, Enzian, calm, unsmiling.
There were others from Gessner's section. Mechanical design I always worked out of Professor Dr. Kurzweg's shop.
Who were the others?
I don't remember.
So?
Don't hit me. Why should I hide anything? It's the truth. They kept us cut off. I didn't know anybody at Nordhausen. Just a few in my own work section. I swear it. The Escaret people were all strangers to me. Until that first day we all met with Major Weissmann, I'd never seen any of them. No one used real names. We were given code names. Characters from a movie, somebody said. The other aerodynamics people were Spurry and Havash. I was called Wenk.
What was your job?
Weight control. All they wanted from me was the shift in CG for a device of a given weight. The weight was classified top secret. 40-something kilos. 45, 46.
Station numbers.
Raps Andreas from over Ensign's shoulder. I can't remember. It was in the tail section. I do remember the load was asymmetrical about the longitudinal axis toward vane 3. That was the vane used for yaw control.
We know that.
You'd have to talk to Spurry or Havash. They'd be the ones who worked that problem out. Talk to guidance.
Why did you say that?
No, it wasn't my job. That's all guidance, warhead propulsion. Ask them, ask the others.
You meant something else. Who worked on guys?
I told you I didn't know any of their names.
The dust-covered cafeteria in the last days. The machinery in the adjoining halls that once battered eardrums pitiless as a cold chisel day and night is silenced. The Roman numerals on the time clocks stare from the walls of the bays among the glass window panes. Telephone jacks on black rubber cords dangle from brackets overhead, each connection hanging over its own desk. All the desks perfectly empty. Covered with salt dust sifted from the ceiling. No phones to plug in, no more words to be said. The face of his friend across the table, the drawn and sleepless face, now too pointed, too lipless, that once vomited beer on Achtbaden's hiking boots, whispering now, I couldn't go with von Braun. Not to the Americans, it would only just keep on the same way. I wanted really to be over, that's all. Goodbye, Wenk.
Stuff him down the waistlines, Andreas suggests.
They are all so black, so sure. I must be the last one. Somebody's sure to have him by now. What can these Africans do with a name? They could have got it from anybody.
He was a friend. We knew each other before the war at Darmstadt. We're not going to hurt him. We're not going to hurt you. We want the Escaret.
Nerisch. Klaus Nerisch.
A new parameter for his self-coefficient now. Betrayal.
As he leaves the Rücksichtsschloss, Achtbaden can hear behind him metallic broadcasting from another world, ripped by static, a radio voice. Oberst Ensign, Meokomanga, Meokomanga, Meokomanga.
There is urgency and gravity in the word. He stands by the canal side, among steel wreckage and old men in the dusk, waiting for a direction to go. But where is the electric voice now that will ever call for him?
They have set out by barge along the Spree-Oder Canal, headed at last for Swinemünde, Sothrop to see what gaily tripping's crew will lead him to in the way of a Schwarzgerät, Margarita to rendezvous with a yacht full of refugees from the Lublin regime, among whom ought to be her daughter Bianca. Stretches of the canal are still blocked. In the night, Russian demolition crews can be heard blasting away the wrecks with TNT, but Slothrop and Greta can summon, like dreamers, draft shallow enough to clear whatever the war has left in their way. Off and on it rains. The sky will begin to cloud up about noon, turning the color of wet cement. Then wind sharpening, colder. Then rain that must be often at the edge of sleet, blowing at them head-on up the canal. They shelter under tarps, among bales and barrels, tar, wood, and straw smells. When the nights are clear, peepers and frogs' nights, star streaks and shadows at canal side will set travelers' eyes to jittering. Willows line the banks. At midnight, coils of fog rise to dim out even the glow of the bargee's pipe. Far away up or down, the dreaming convoy. These nights, fragrant and grained as pipe smoke, are tranquil and good for sleep. The Berlin madness is behind. Greta seems less afraid. Perhaps all they needed was to be on the move. But one afternoon, sliding down the long, mild slope of the Oder toward the Baltic Sea, they catch sight of a little red and white resort town,
wiped through in broad smudges by the war, and she clutches to Slothrop's arm.
I've been here.
Yeah?
Just before the Polish invasion, I was here with Sigmund at the spa.
On shore, behind cranes and steel railings, rise fronts of what were restaurants. Small factories, hotels, burned now, windowless, powdered with their own substance. The name of the town is Bad Karma. Rain from earlier in the day has streaked the walls, the pinnacles of waste and the coarse cobbled lanes. Children and old men stand on shore, waiting to take lines and warp the barges in. Black dumplings of smoke are floating up out of the stack of a white river steamer. Shipfitters are slamming inside its hull. Greta stares at it. A pulse is visible in her throat. She takes her head.
I thought it was Bianca's ship, but it isn't.
In close to the quay, they swing ashore, grabbing onto an iron ladder held in the old stone by rusted bolts, each one staining the wall downward in a wet sienna fan. On Margarita's jacket, a pink gardenia has begun to shake. It isn't the wind. She keeps saying, I have to see. Old men are leaning on railings, smoking pipes, watching Greta or looking out at the river. They wear gray clothes, wide-bottom trousers, wide-brim hats with rounded crowns. The market square is busy and neat. Tram tracks gleam. There's a smell of fresh hosing down. In the ruins, lilacs bleed their color, their surplus life out over the broken stone and brick. Except for a few figures in black, sitting out in the sun, the spa itself is deserted. Margarita by now is spooked as badly as she ever was in Berlin. Slothrop tags along in his rocket man turnout, feeling burdened. The Sprudelhof is bounded on one side by a sand-colored arcade, sand columns and brown shadows. A strip just in front is planted to cypresses. Fountains in massive stone bowls are leaping, jets 20 feet high, whose shadows across the smooth paving of the courtyard are thick and nervous. But who's that standing so rigid by the central spring? And why has Margarita turned to stone? The sun is out. There are others watching, but even Slothrop now is bristling along his back and flanks, chills flung one on the fading cluster of another, up under each side of his jaw. The woman is wearing a black coat, a crepe scarf covering her hair, the flesh of thick calves showing through her black stockings as nearly purple. She is only leaning over the waters in a very fixed way and watching them as they try to approach. But the smile, across 10 meters of swept courtyard, the smile growing confident in the very white face. All the malaise of a Europe dead and gone gathered here in the eyes black as her clothing, black and lightless. She knows them. Greta has turned and tries to hide her face in Slothrop's shoulder.
By the well. Is she whispering this? At sundown, that woman in black.
Come on, it's all right. Back to Berlin talk. She's just a patient here. Idiot. Idiot. Before he can stop her, she's pulled away, some quiet, awful cry in the back of her throat, and turned and begun to run, a desperate tattoo of high heels across the stone into the shadowed arches of the Kurhaus. Hey, Slothrop, feeling queasy, accosts the woman in black. What's the big idea, lady?
But her face has changed by now. It is only the face of another woman of the ruins, one he would have ignored, passed over.
She smiles, all right, but in the forced and business way he knows.
Zigaretten, bitte?
He gives her a long stub he's been saving and goes looking for Margarita. He finds the arcade empty. All the doors of the Kurhaus are locked. Overhead passes a skylight of yellow panes, many of them fallen out. Down the corridor, fuzzy patches of afternoon sun stagger along, full of mortar dust. He climbs a broken flight of steps that end in the sky. Odd chunks of stone clutter the way. From the landing at the top, the spa stretches to country distances, handsome trees, graveyard, clouds, the blue river. Greta is nowhere in sight. Later, he will figure out where it was she went. By then, they will be well on board the Anubis, and it will only make him feel more helpless. He keeps looking for her till the darkness is down, and he's come back by the river again.
He sits at an open-air cafe strung with yellow lights, drinking beer, eating spätzle and soup, waiting.
When she materializes, it is a shy fade-in,
as Gerhard von Göhr must have brought her on a time or two, not moving so much as Slothrop's own vantage swooping to her silent close-up, stabilized presently across from him, finishing his beer, bumming a cigarette. Not only does she avoid the subject of the woman by the spring, she may have lost the memory already. "I went up in the observatory," is what she has to say, finally, "to look down the river. She's coming. I saw the boat she's on. It's only a kilometer away." "The what now?" "Bianca, my child, and my friends. I thought they'd have been in Swinemünde long ago, but then nobody's on timetables anymore."
Sure enough, after two more bitter cups of acorn coffee and another cigarette, here comes a cheerful array of lights, red, green, and white, down the river, with the faint wheeze of an accordion, the thump of a string bass, and the sound of women laughing. Slothrop and Greta walk down to the quay, and through mist now beginning to seep up off the river, they can make out an ocean-going yacht, nearly the color of the mist, a gilded winged jackal under the bowsprit, the weather decks crowded with chattering affluent in evening dress. Several people have spotted Margarita. She waved, and they point or wave back and call her name. It is a moving village. All summer it has been sailing these lowlands just as Viking ships did 1,000 years ago, though passively, not marauding, seeking an escape it has not yet defined clearly. The boat comes into the quay, the crew lower an access ladder, smiling passengers halfway down or already stretching out gloved and ringed hands to Margarita. "Are you coming? Well, should I?" She shrugs and turns her back, steps gingerly off the landing and on board, skirt straining and glossy a moment in the yellow light from the cafe. Slothrop dithers, goes to follow her. At the last moment, some joker pulls the ladder up and the boat moves away. Slothrop screams, loses his balance, and falls in the river, head first. The rocket man helmet is pulling him straight down. He tugs it off and comes up, sinuses burning and vision blurred, the white vessel sliding away, though the turning screws are moving his direction, beginning to suck at the cape, so he has to get rid of that too. He backstrokes away, and then cautiously around the counter, lettered in black, "Anubis Schwinoistje," trying to keep away from those screws. Down the other side, he spots a piece of line hanging and manages to get over there and grab hold. The band up on deck is playing polkas. Three drunken ladies in tiaras and pearl chokers are lounging at the lifelines, watching Slothrop struggle up the rope. "Let's cut it," yells one of them, "and see him fall in again." "Yes, let's," agree her companions. Jesus Christ. One of them has produced a huge meat cleaver and is winding up all right amid much vivacious laughing, at about which point somebody grabs hold of Slothrop's ankle. He looks down, observes sticking out a portal two slender wrists in silver and sapphires, lighted from inside like ice in the oily river rushing by underneath. "In here," a girl's voice. He slides back down while she tugs on his feet till he's sitting in the portal. From above comes a heavy thump. The rope goes falling and the ladies into hysterics. Slothrop squirms on inside, water squeegeeing off, falls into an upper bunk next to a girl maybe 18 in a long sequined gown with hair blonde to the point of pure whiteness and the first cheekbones Slothrop can recall getting a hard-on looking at. Something has definitely been happening to his brain out here, all right. They look at each other while he continues to drip water all over. Her name, it turns out, is Stefania Protalowska. Her husband, Antoni, is owner of the Anubis here. Well, husband, all right. "Look at this," says Slothrop. "I'm soaking wet."
"I noticed somebody's evening clothes ought to fit you. Dry off. I'll go see what I can promote. You can use the head if you want. Everything's here."
He strips off the rest of the rocket man rig, takes a shower using lemon verbena soap in which he finds a couple of Stefania's white pubic hairs, and is shaving when she gets back with dry clothes for him.
"So you're with Margarita?" "Not sure about that with. She find that kid of hers?"
"Oh, indeed. They're already deep into it with Carl. This month he's posing as a film producer. You know Carl, and of course she wants to get Bianca into the films worse than anything."
Stefania shrugs a lot, and every sequin dances. "Margarita wants her to have a legitimate career. It's guilt. She never felt her own career was anything more than a string of dirty movies. I suppose you heard about how she got pregnant with Bianca."
"Max Schleipzig or something?"
"Or something, right. You never saw Abdulkin? In that one scene, after the Grand Inquisitor gets through, the jackal men come in to ravish and dismember the captive baroness. Van Gerl let the cameras run right on. The footage got cut out for the release prints, of course, but found its way into Goebbels' collection. I've seen it. It's frightening. Every man in the scene wears a black hood or an animal mask. At Bydgoszcz, it became an amusing party game to speculate on who the child's father was. One has to pass the time. They'd run the film and ask Bianca questions, and she had to answer yes or no.
Yep, Sothrup goes on, dousing his face with bay rum.
Oh, Margarita had her corrupted long before she came to stay with us. I wouldn't be surprised if little Bianca sleeps with Carl tonight. Part of breaking into the business, isn't it? Of course, it will have to be all business. That's the least a mother can do. Margarita's problem was that she always enjoyed it too much, chained up in those torture rooms. She couldn't enjoy it any other way. You'll see, she and Tanatz and whatever Tanatz brought in his valise.
Tanatz.
Ah, she didn't tell you.
Laughing.
Miklos Tanatz, her husband. They get together off and on. Toward the end of the war, they had a little touring show for the boys at the front. A lesbian couple, a dog, a trunk of leather costumes and implements, a small band. They entertained the SS troops. Concentration camps, the barbed wire circuit, you know. And then later in Holland, out at the rocket sites. This is the first time since the surrender they've been together, so I wouldn't actually expect to see too much of her.
Oh, yeah, well, I didn't know that.
Rocket sites?
The hand of Providence creeps among the stars, giving Slothrop the finger.
While they were away, they left Bianca with us at Bydgoszcz. She has her bitchy moments, but she's really a charming child. I never played the father game with her. I doubt she had a father. It was parthenogenesis. She's pure Margarita, if pure is the word I want.
The evening clothes fit perfectly. Stefania leads Slothrop up a companionway and out on deck. The Anubis moves now through starlit countryside, the horizon broken now and then by silhouettes of windmill, haycocks, a row of pig arks, some line of trees set on a low hill for the wind. There are ships we can dream across terrible rapids, against currents. Our desire is wind and motor.
Antony.
She has brought Slothrop to an enormous figure in Polish cavalry fatigues and with a lot of maniacal teeth.
American?
Pumping Slothrop's hand.
Bravo, you nearly complete the set. We are the ship of all nations now. We've even got a Japanese on board. An ex-liaison man from Berlin who didn't quite get out by way of Russia. You'll find a bar on the next deck. Anything wandering around, hugging Stefania to him. Except this one is fair game.
Slothrop salutes, gathers they would like to be alone, and finds the ladder to the bar. The bar is hung with festive garlands of flowers and light bulbs, and crowded with dozens of elegantly decked guests, who have just now, with the band accompanying, broken into this up-tempo song. Welcome aboard. Welcome aboard, gee, it's a fabulous oar, gee, that you just dropped in on, my friend. We can't recall just how it started, but there's only one way it can end. The behavior is bestial, hardly Marie Celestial, but you'll fit right in with the crowd if you jettison all of those problems and keep it hysterically loud. There are mothers with their lovers stealing rotters from their daughters, big erections, predilections that you wouldn't believe, so put your brain on your sleeve and come aboard the Titanic. Things will really be manic. Folks will panic the second that sunken iceberg is knocked. Naughty and noisy and very Walpurgisnacht. That's how the party will end, so welcome aboard, my friend.
Well, here's couples moaning together in the lifeboats. The drunks gone to sleep in the awning over Slothrop's head. Fat fellows in white gloves with pink magnolias in their hair are dancing tummy to tummy and murmuring together in Wendish. Hands grope down inside satin gowns. Waiters with brown skins and doe eyes circulate with trays on which you are likely to find any number of substances and paraphernalia. The band is playing a medley of American foxtrots. The Baron de Malacastra sifts the sinister white powder into the highball of Madame Stupp. It is the same old shit that was going on back at Raoul de Lepelin-Pepin's place, and for all Slothrop knows, it's the same party. He gets a glimpse of Margarita and her daughter, but there is a density of orgy-goers around them that keeps him at a distance. He knows he's vulnerable, more than he should be, to pretty little girls, so he reckons it's just as well, because that Bianca's a knockout, all right. 11 or 12, dark and lovely,
wearing a red on gown, silk stockings, and high-heeled slippers, elaborate and flawless and interwoven with a string of pearls to show pendant earrings of crystal twinkling from her tiny lobes. Help! Help! Why do these things have to keep coming down on him? You can see the obit now in Time magazine. Died, rocket man, pushing 30, in the zone of lust. The woman who tried to chop Sothrup down with the cleaver is now seated on a bit, holding a half-liter of some liquid which has already seeped into and begun to darken the orchid, garnishing it. She is telling everybody a story about Margarita. Her hair has been combed or styled in a way that makes it look like a certain cut of meat. Sothrup's drink, nominally Irish whiskey and water, arrives. Her Neptune is afflicted. Whose isn't? Some will ask, but as residents on this planet, usually... Greta lived most of the time on Neptune. Her affliction was more direct, purer, clearer than we know it. She found Dine, failed. Side the Thames, as geranium slow to tell, brass mellow peach light, was being drafted on and to regenerate there. As this happened to the day's light, he fell. A fall of hours, less extravagant than Lucifer's, but in the same way part of a deliberate pattern. Greta was meant to find Onarine. Each carries its signature. Some are gods, some masquerade as gods. This is an advanced kind of forgery. Still, there's the same meanness and mortality to it as a falsely made check. It is only more complex. The members have names like the archangels, more or less common, humanly given names whose security can be broken and the names learned, but these names are not magic. That's the key, that's the difference. Spoken aloud, even with the purest magical intention, they do not work. So he fell from their grace. So there was no Chlorine. So she happened to meet V. Mann Wimpe in the street, in Berlin, under a theater marquee whose sentient bulbs may have looked on, a picturesque array of extras, witnesses to grave historic encounters. So she had come to Oin, and the face of her afflicted home planet was rearranged in the instant. Honorin, Jampf Imipolex A4. That silly bitch, observes a voice at Slothrop's elbow. Tells it worse every time. Beg pardon? Sothrup looks around and finds Miklos Tatt's full beard, eyebrows feathering out like trailing edges of hawk's wings, drinking absinthe out of a cistine on which, in colors made ghastly by the carnival lights on deck, bony and giggling death is about to surprise two lovers in bed. There is no problem steering him onto the subject of the rocket. I think of the A4, says he, as a baby Jesus, with endless committees of Herods out to destroy it in infancy, Prussians, some of whom in their innermost hearts still felt artillery to be a dangerous innovation. If you'd been out there, inside all, you grew docile under its... It really did possess a Max Weber charisma, some joyful and deeply irrational force the state bureaucracy never routinized. It could not prevail. They did resist it, but they also allowed it to happen. We can't imagine anyone choosing a role like that, but every year somehow their numbers grow. But the tour with General Tumler's rocketeers is what Sothrup perversely wants to know about. Well, I've been to that Nordhaus and sure seen the bits and pieces, but never a fully assembled A4. That must really be something, huh? And that is holding out his time for a refill. The deadpan dribbles water down a spoon to turn the absinthe milky green while Tanatz caresses his buttocks, then moves away. It is not clear if Anat has been thinking about his answer. Yes, fueled, alive, ready for firing. 50 feet high, trembling. And then the fantastic, virile roar. Your ears nearly burst. Cruel, hard, thrusting into the blue robes of the sky, my friend Phallic, wouldn't you say? Yeah, you would have got on with them out at the battery. More studious than your infantry or panther types, attentive to the point of fanaticism. Oh, with notable exceptions, of course. One lives for notable exceptions. There was a boy. Drunk reminiscence? Is he faking this? His name was Gottfried. God's peace. I trust he's found. For us, I hold no such hope. We are weighed in the balance and found wanting. And the butcher has had his thumb in the scales. You think I'm jaded? So did I until that terrible week. It was a time of dissolution, falling back across the Niedersächsisch oil fields. Then I understood I was but a dewy child. The battery commander had become a screaming maniac. He called him Zero.
He'd begun to talk the way the captain in Wojciech sings, his voice breaking suddenly up into the higher registers of hysteria.
Things were falling apart, and he reverted to some ancestral version of himself, screamed at the sky, sat hours in a rigid trance with his eyes rolled clear up into his head, breaking without warning into that ungodly coloratura. White blank ovals, the eyes at you, with the gray rain behind them. He had left 1945, wired his nerves back into the pre-Christian earth we fled across, into the Urstoff of the primitive German, God's poorest and most panicked creature. You and I perhaps have become over the generation so Christianized, so enfeebled by Gesellschaft, obligation to its celebrated contract, which never did exist, that we, even we, are appalled by